a lot of what you've heard so far has been a little bit over the top. We don't know what to say about it. People have been very persuasive, and I certainly can't match the eloquence of previous speakers, and they've persuaded me that a lot of what they're saying may actually have some truth to it, which really raises the question, if there is so much to celebrate, who is it exactly who should be getting the credit? I think of those whom I owe so much, start with the third group, students. Clearly, everything in terms of communicating, in terms of my own development over the last 39 years, contribution I've made depends completely upon the students. Mishpacha Lomedet. And it's also very, very clear that I deserve no credit at all for their having come to me. I don't have the skills of forceful personality of getting people to follow me around. And if people have attached themselves to me and contributed to me and gotten something from me, it is completely their commitment has absolutely nothing to do with any merit on my part. Where I think I do deserve a great deal of credit is in my the choice of my parents. Here's really a very brilliant choice. I should be credited for. I picked them. I stuck with them. They were stuck with me. I'll tell you why it was such a brilliant choice. Think what my father was. I was a person with absolutely no formal second education. His Jewish education ended when he was about 8 or 9. He had to go into the workforce. At the age of 15, he was in the United States, as he liked to put it, all alone. He spent his working career mostly as a factory worker, the person who, as he put it, dragged 50-pound sacks of sugar up steps and emptied them into a vat. At the same time, despite lack of background, despite the atmosphere he was working in, when he was able to, some years later, he went back to learning. And by early 1940s, he was giving Gemara Shir, Rapala Mizrahi of Brownsville, imagine, when you're a person without any background, sitting away after a day of very hard labor, late at night, early in the morning, and gaining that kind of competence. In general reading, he read what intelligent factory workers read, and I think today people might consider a little sophisticated. I remember that I was reading Heidegger, and Heidegger has a discussion of a Norwegian novelist named Knut Hamsun, who's today probably forgotten. At the time he was a Nobel Prize winner. And I was interested because of Heidegger, and my father had read him. Dickens, he read some Shakespeare. But this was not a matter of formal education, was a matter of having enough curiosity to want to know, want to understand something about the world around him. My mother was a high school graduate in Poland. She had some additional background, and she was at an agricultural training program of Zionist nature in a place called Pleshev, where her parents were later sent to be killed. She read some books. She thought about things. So here I had parents who were not at all formally educated, who took ideas seriously, and who took what being a human being is about seriously. My mother, the first thing was to be a human being. Early days, I always say, it's just because you've read some books does not mean anything in terms of counts in life. And those, you know, shoulders, she didn't talk that way anymore. So, you know, then she would say, just because you've written a lot of good things doesn't mean anything. And that was very important in terms of where it came from. And I owe so much to that kind of background. Lastly, in terms of my teachers, it shows my teachers very well as well. Rav Lichtenstein. Three people whom I regard as teachers of mine in a significant sense. Really should have been in the book, but fortunately they're not here anymore. They were enormous value to me. Yosef Wernevsky, Zichron Bracha. Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Zichron Bracha. And Rabbi Aaron Levine, Zichron Bracha. There could have been a way to get them in the book posthumously. I wish we could have done it. It would have been a problem for the editors. Rabbi Wurzberger would have written much more concisely than you wanted. Rabbi Levine would have written at greater length than you wanted. And Rabbi Wernevsky would have needed some help in terms of the, you know, physical act of writing. But these are people who traveled a very long road with me, and I don't know what I would have done without them, and we should remember them now. By coming to YU, I really don't have to take credit. My father wanted me to be here, and he engineered it, influenced me to be here. Once I was here, though, I benefited from those teachers, and they determine, to a large extent, whatever is worthwhile in my work today. And I said, like my mother, those of you who were at the cemetery for the unveiling, that if I was only my father's son, I would not have survived YU politics for 35 years. And now it's time to say that if I were not my father's son, I would not have deserved to have the long career that I had. I came to YU, and the question was, what am I going to do with my life? It was an occasion that I realized that I would be speaking about it some years later. I would have remembered the details much more exactly, but it was December 31st, 1969, sometime between 3:30 and 4:30 in the afternoon, speaking with Lichtenstein, and he asked me, where do you see yourself? The question was about America versus Israel. And as usually happens in Lichtenstein's presence, you tend to think more seriously than when you're on your own. And I said, quote, wherever I can accomplish the most. I got back to my room and I realized that I had said what I really thought. I had to accomplish something. Those of you who really go back with me a long way will remember it was a novel by Graham Greene called The Power and Glory that was very important to me in those years. I still recommend it. And you'll remember that the protagonist of the book is last night, and soon he's going to be shot. And what haunts him is how little he's accomplished. What does it mean to have to go to God empty-handed with nothing done at all. Nothing done at all. And that was a passage that I thought about a great deal as well. How am I going to go to God? How am I going to accomplish something genuinely worthwhile? What am I supposed to do with myself? And I knew at that point my preoccupations were self-centered. I was interested in figuring out what my life is about, what I'm supposed to be doing. Someone said earlier about intellectual breadth. The truth is, from my point of view, I didn't see in myself great breadth. I saw one question over and over and over again. What am I supposed to do with my life? It happens that that question led me into a variety of directions and a variety of interests. But it was really that one question, that one obsession. I mean, when thinking the, you know, some of these apartment buildings in Israel, they don't have lights in the, in the stairwell. So there's a button, you press the button, and the lights go on in the hallway, and you have 60 seconds to get where you want to get and figure out where you are. You press the button, there's a noise as all these lights go on at once, and if you press the wrong button, of course, you can get a much more shrill noise and you can wake people up. And I realized that while I was trying to find my own way and pressing this button and someone pressing the wrong button, that what I was doing could give light to other people and could sometimes shake up other people. But that's not exactly a way of making a living. I mean, how do you translate that into kind of routine, stability, salary? The path of least resistance is to stay in school forever. And many people mapped out for me this glorious road of going to graduate school and writing term papers for a few years. And then if you finally reach the end of that process and you're fortunate, you get a job. And if you get a job and you're fortunate, you continue to produce term papers and everything works out well, then 14, 15 years after you start this process, you get tenure. Meanwhile, there's a certain sacrifice of intellectual breadth. You become narrower and narrower. You're dealing not with the things that really concern you or would even concern your potential talmidim, assuming that you're ever going to have any. You are writing in a style that is not geared to grapple with real things, but some other kinds of things. And it's a lottery. Everything has to work out well. And meanwhile, the time is passing. And here, to be honest, my chances were not the greatest because I don't have the social skills, self-promotion and networking and impressing the kind of people that I have to impress. And let's be honest, modern Orthodox framework didn't have family connections either. One option was go to Israel and teach math in a border town or in a development town. That I knew the kind of situation there. I knew that a person who could teach high school kids would have a real impact. And in math, you don't have the kind of problems you have in Gemara and in philosophy of figuring out how to explain something to people on a lower level. In math, either you explain it well or you don't explain it well. If you understand it, you should be able to explain it. I thought that would at least be a contribution. If I'd gone that way, I don't know if I would have had the strength of character to carry it through. It certainly would have been a much lonelier life. It certainly would have been a sacrifice of my own intellectual development, perhaps beyond what I even imagined at that point. And it might have been a loss to some other people as well. But that was an option. And other two options were simply a matter of drifting along and waiting for some sort of turn up, as character in Tale of Two Cities puts it. I had a fantasy, of course. And again, I know you'll laugh at me, but please, it's so outlandish. You know, I wonder if I even admitted it to myself. I think my friends probably figured out something to that effect, but, you know, how I could live with that kind of unreality, I don't know. But the fantasy was that I would have an opportunity to teach. My life would be primarily in Torah study. And there, do what I, things I was good at, snach machshava, and have an opening to do other things as well, to continue to learn Gemara. And at the same time, part-time, I would teach philosophy, and I would do other things in humanities, again, whatever I pleased. You understand very well that this was total fantasy. And again, the possibility that the world would suddenly make a way for a person, again, didn't have those aggressive salesmanship qualities. And people just arrange this to my satisfaction. It was impossible. It's unimaginable. If you go even beyond that and say that things I would write would be of value not only to people in my own immediate surroundings, but I could reach a non-Jewish audience, and that the kind of major figures in a variety of fields, in religion and law and other areas, that I would sit and read their books in the library, and I would have the opportunity to meet with them, and that they should read what I'm writing and interact with them. This would totally be beyond any imagining. Whether such things happen in the real world is strange, and one of the older people contributed to this book once said to Abby Wolfish during the 1970s, you know, one way or another, Sholem is going to get what he wants. He probably did figure out what I was aiming at, but that was nevuah. In this case, it was not nevuah that was given to the fool, it was actually nevuah given to a very wise person. Maybe it was a bracha as well. Zchut bracha. Things worked out for me. I would like to say something further about two people who were important in Brooklyn culture as a small child. And thanks to my father, I found out about them. So both people actually reached recognition fairly late in life, very late in their careers, compared to what should have been the result of the political craziness that you had in the 20th century. But before I get to that, just refresh ourselves, take a break, and discuss a couple lines of Rabbanan Chumash. So these those people who are worried about Bitul Torah feel that they learned something, and maybe it will help us later on as well. My father's Chon Avracha, a strange characteristic which I've adopted from him. He didn't believe in announcing that he was going to give a donation. If it was an appeal, he would not respond at all. And as far as he was concerned, you don't promise things. You write the check, that's when you make your commitment. And I've noticed that the Ramban seems to have some sympathy with that outlook as well, because I'm going through Chumash and I see that whenever people take a Shvua, he seems to feel the need to explain why this oath was really necessary. In Chai Sara, Avram makes a servant Eliezer take an oath that he will find the wife to Yitzchak the way that Avram wants. And Rabban points out that Avram said nothing at all to Yitzchak about it. He certainly didn't make him swear. He didn't even instruct him about it. And Rabban says he didn't need to. After all, Yitzchak knew Avram's will, and Avram trusted Yitzchak that he would do what Avram wanted him to do. The servant, even a reliable servant, he felt he had to administer an oath to. Son, he didn't have to do. And why am I telling this now? We should have discussed it a month ago, Chai Sara, which they actually did, and sure, so sure, they actually did discuss it. But now we're Parshvechi. The reason I'm mentioning it to you now is that a similar problem that Ramban this week. Yaakov makes Yosef take an oath that he'll bury him in Eretz Yisrael. And Ramban asked, presumably Ramban remembered what he had said last month. Ramban says, of course, Yaakov did not really have to impose an oath upon Yosef. The reason he was doing so was that Yosef would have an excuse to Paro. If Paro says, why do you have to take your father to Canaan? Or if he says, I want you here. Or if Paro says, I want Yaakov to remain here. He's a holy man. Good luck. Then, rather than Yosef saying, I don't want to do what you're telling me to do, Yosef could say, what can I do? I took a shvua, mushba bon har Sinai. I promised my father, and I'm stuck with that promise. And this is indeed what happened. Paro says to Yosef, go up and bury your father as you have sworn, because Paro is aware that that shvua binds him. Ramban's characters, you know, one of his most endearing characteristics, that he will give you an idea, and then he'll add another few words, and it's not clear always whether those extra few words are a qualification of the original idea, or those extra few words are an overflowing of his mind into some new idea that was not the major idea he wanted, but he just can't help expressing. Ramban goes on and says another few words. And this forced Yosef to go and do this personally. So I'm not sure, does doing this personally mean it's an excuse he can make to Paro? I have to travel with the corpse because of my Shavua. Or whether it means that even without that, even without Paro, that Yosef might have said, I'm busy man, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, but if somebody else takes care of it, it's okay. So this way, we're taking the Shavua, he feels more obligated to act on his own. Well, as we discussed the Ramban, Riyotzi Tom Torah, and I promised, didn't take an oath, but I promised that I would tell you all about these two gentlemen from Brooklyn, something I never told anybody about, even the old-timers here. Then these are people who had enormous influence on me. These are people who I've been thinking about lately for a variety of reasons. Roy Campanella was catcher for the Dodgers, late 1940s, early 1950s, most valuable player 3 times. The bulwark of that great team. He came to Major Leagues pretty late in life. He was black, and he was one of the first blacks to reach the Major Leagues. And he didn't want to retire. Since both these people had very different attitudes to retirements. He did not want to retire by any means. And he used to say, the only way to retire is if they tear the uniform off me. Kachaya. It was one night, he was in an automobile accident, and he was paralyzed from the neck down the rest of his life. As a small child, believed in the power of words and the prophetic power, I said to myself, you know, it's true. The only way he could retire was if they tore the uniform off. Very striking image for a child. The second person was Jackie Robinson, who's probably better known to many of you. First black, break the color line. Robinson was a much sharper person outside baseball than Campanella. He'd gone to college. A person who thought seriously about religion. He was a great theologian. If you read some of his letters, you read Arnold Rampersand's biography of him, you'll see religious thinking. And he was what, if he'd been a Jew, they would have said that he was pushy. And as a black man, the term it was used in those days was uppity. He didn't always know his place. Now, ordinarily, a person of that intelligence, when time came for him to retire, they would have to give him a position within the organization. And historians claim that they were reluctant to do so because they thought he was too abrasive and too vigorous. So they traded him to the Giants for Dick Littlefield and $50,000. And he retired, moved on to other things. Campanella is listed as the author of an autobiography. Title is interesting, apt. It's Good to Be Alive. Robinson's last autobiography, which was published shortly before his death, is called I Never Had It Made. These are both good titles. On the one hand, it's good to be alive. And you can resonate to that desire. A person, as long as you're alive, as long as you can do something, you don't retire until they tear the uniform off you. And certainly, I remember Rabbi Wurzburger come to class when he couldn't walk from the parking lot to first hall, and they had to leave him off, and his wife had to leave him off on the sidewalk in front of the building. And he still kept working and keeping up in the areas that were, philosophies were important to him, areas of learning were important to him. I remember very recently, Roy Levine was in enormous pain. He had to climb one or two steps or step down. It was agonizing to look at him. And you put him in front of a computer screen, you put him in front of a classroom. Even as long as he could, you told him that there was somebody in his congregation that was sick in some hospital somewhere, and he went, and he was himself. I remember the day in November 1985 when Ravzitzel said to me, Carmi, I don't know how much longer I can do this, and what pain there was in his realization that he was approaching the end of the road as a public figure. And I cannot forget my mother's last Friday on earth. She got out of her deathbed and she cooked for Shabbos. I thought that this was sort of the herald of another marvelous recovery. But I realized later the look in her eyes, the look of triumph, was saying to me, I want you to remember me this way. I want you to remember me doing things for other people, doing things for myself. It's good to be alive. If you look at it the right way, it's wonderful to be alive. But if I had to choose one title over the other, the title we should choose is They Never Had It Made. We never had it made. We should not delude ourselves because we succeeded in certain things, because the facilities, both intellectual and otherwise, are better than they may have been before. The last 40 years have been good for the university in many respects. There are many important improvements. The last 10 years, we shouldn't think that things are good, because things are not as good as they ought to be. In certain respects, they're very difficult. We think about simple Jewish awareness, I mean human awareness. And we see young people, intelligent young people, go through 12 years of yeshiva education, thousands and thousands of hours, one on top of the other, and a year or two in Israel. All of this huge amount of time. And very often they come out with almost no sense at all of what religious life is about, what a thinking intellectual life is about. There are people over all these years have never actually encountered a religious individual. Of course, they may have been in the same room as a religious individual. They may have heard such a person speak, but they have never actually understood what makes such a person tick, what that person has to communicate. They've never looked at the world from a religious point of view, as opposed to a secular worldview with some additional bells and whistles. And what do we give them over those years and at the end of those years? We give them some kind of objective, scholarly information about things. Information about halacha, information about Jewish history, dispassionate analysis without commitment, with a commitment very much bracketed. Often, the level of discourse sinks beneath the highest scholarly level, and intellectual life becomes gossip. Who is reviewing whose book? Who is getting this professorship, that professorship? Is so-and-so a good scholar? Is he a mediocre scholar? Is he worthy being a full professor? Is he only worthy being a half-full professor? And, you know, part of that intellectual milieu is also very often kind of pseudo-kfira, which can even sink into real kfira, pushing envelopes, trying to figure out how little you can believe in, how you can be cynical while still remaining within the limits of orthodoxy. And that counts as being an intellectual, as being sophisticated. Or when we are not in our pedantic mood and we're not in our iconoclastic moods, become pious, and we offer fluff, darshanus, homiletics. We talk gematriot, and we put together ideas that have nothing in common with each other, and as long as it somehow flows and we're able to repeat it, we are impressed with our own ingenuity. We lick the sweetness off of our fingers, which is so impressed with ourselves. And meanwhile, what are we offering to the people who are looking to us for sustenance? What are we giving them? We then train ourselves that way. Our rabbinic training focuses that way. Our graduate school training means another 10, 12, 15 years of being more narrow and more detached and more concerned with academic politics and more concerned with saying nice things, whether or not they address real issues. Where are we then? Lichtenstein, in his essay in this book, quotes Milton, the Lycidas, that the hungry sheep look up and are not fed. If he had quoted all of what Milton says in the context, it would might turn some people's stomachs. It refers to the would-be shepherds, the leaders, supposed intellectual leaders, religious leaders, blind mouths. Wonderful image, a blind mouth. That scarce themselves know how to hold a sheep hook, or have learnt aught else the least to the faithful herdman's art belongs. And the sheep, Milton says, are swollen with wind, and the rank mist they draw, rot inwardly, and foul contagion spread, besides what the grim wolf of privy paw daily devours apace, and nothing said. Meaning people who are themselves don't have what to communicate, or people actually can communicate contagion, communicate the wrong attitudes, who lower the level of the sheep who turn to them for food and are not fed. And we have to say that there's a point where for ourselves, whether we are mechanchim or professors or rabbanim or parents have responsibilities to their children also. They're responsible to the community. And a responsibility to ourselves. We have to educate ourselves. We have to build ourselves up some way. And there's a point where we have to say, to Paro, whether Paro is president of a shul, or somebody in a tenure committee, or a parent with certain ideas of what a school ought to teach and what's impressive in a curriculum. Paro pre-professionalism. At the time we have to tell Paro, look, with all due respect, we've made a commitment. And Paro has to understand we have a commitment that may not be Paro's commitment. And we have to make Paro respect that commitment. Of course, Paro may not, even when we explain to him, he may not understand what our commitment is really about. You know, Paro may think we're going to bury our father. Paro doesn't know the Gemara in Tan, it's Yaakov Avinu lo met. Yaakov didn't die, despite the fact that the Pesukim spent so much time talking about his burial. That ritual burying Yaakov is not a ritual burial. It's a ritual resurrection. That's why Gemara is concerned about the ritual, not about the fact that Yaakov says, Vayamot Yaakov, that in fact he died. We understand that biologically he died. But he wasn't really embalmed. He was embalmed only for the purpose of keeping him alive. And to that Paro and the Paro within ourselves, we have to say we have responsibility. And we have to say that it's important that we should do it ourselves and not leave it to somebody else to do for us. You realize that we, in this room, we can be the channel of God's voice. We can bring that message to people. People should hear Mashamol Techadureshmimach, what God demands of us. And we can articulate the word of God, our experience of God, Masoda, our interaction with what we've been given by previous generations, directly, personally, through our reading. We can do that. We have to do that. And we communicate God not only by speaking in his voice, by teaching Torah, by studying Torah. There's also the image of God. The image of God is not Torah. The image of God is human creativity, what human beings can discover scientifically, what human beings create verbally, poetry, music. That is Tzelem Elokim, and there are people in this room who can communicate that, who can model that. A few weeks ago, I received via the electronic system a few photographs from the wife of one of the people who wrote in this book. And it's a photograph where he is sitting on the floor with three of his four children, and he's playing with them with a dreidel, and they're also, his talmidim are also sitting on the floor, and they're watching or playing along. They're involved in that. And it's a, to me, it's a moving picture. It's an inspiring picture. It's wonderful. But what's much more important is not just that this Talmud Chacham is spending some time with his children. You know, many people do that. Find the time. Or even with his Talmidim on Hanukkah time. What's important is that the same person who is sitting on the floor with them, it's a person who, when these Talmidim come to him with their concerns, with their questions, what's troubling them, what ought to trouble them, he is not going to give them the stone of impersonal, detached academics. He'll give them bread. He will not give them the muddied water of gossip or the foul water of the wise guy, kfira. He will give them living water. And when they come to him for sustenance, he will not give them only the empty calories of drush. He will relate to what's really important, and he will teach them skills and the existential wherewithal to deal with Torah, to deal with life, to think ahead. It's interesting that I look at this book, and apart from the quality of the material, and my initial reaction was to be impressed by the range of fields that people deal with here. Every single person in this book, including even the faculty in this book, are people who understand this sense of priority. That scholarship may be valuable, it may be a good thing to contribute to scholarship, but the purpose, the overriding goal, is that that scholarship has to be in the service of the most important things in life. And it's very flattering that these people come together and do it with me, people have been with me for so many years, share in that struggle. I mentioned Pato earlier, and reminded of an actor who played Pato in the Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Ten Commandments, Yul Brynner. And I first encountered him in that role, but I later discovered that he was more famous for another role in theater. He was the king in Anna and King of Siam. You're right. And he played that role thousands and thousands of times. He's always reviving it. He's very identified with that role. A journalist once asked him, some of you have heard this from me already, but he gave you some new material, so bear with me repeating something. A journalist asked him, how can you keep giving the same performance night after night? Every year you're doing Intro to the Bible, every year responding to the same questions about Hashkafa, and Yul Brynner answered, when I'm doing it for the 3,000th time, it's not new to me. But there may be somebody in the audience, some couple from the Midwest, and this is their big vacation, the time they're coming to New York on vacation, and part of the New York vacation they planned for and dreamed about was a Broadway show. And they're coming there, and they're looking forward to it. For me, it's the 3,000th time. For them, it's the first time. It's the important time. And I have to think about them when I give the performance. Now, you know, she's quite aware that there may be people coming to the theater who really are not interested. Somebody may be dragged to theater because his wife wants to go to theater. Somebody wants to be pretentious and show off that he goes to the theater. A pretentious person really should be going to a concert of classical music or to a museum or probably get more pretension points out of that. But he knows that there are people who don't necessarily want to be there. There are people at that performance who are checking their cell phones. The people may walk out to the bathroom for half the performance and wander back in. The people who are in the honors program, they need to get credit for having gone to a cultural activity. The people sitting there who may be playing with a Pez dispenser. but there's that couple who came from the Midwest, and for them, what he is doing is something important. We have it a little bit harder in a way, because if people are coming to us, it's very often it's our last chance to wake them up. And for us, it's the 3,000th time, and for them, it's the 3,001st time. Because they think they've heard it all. And Wittgenstein once said that if lions could speak, nobody would understand them. Because you simply don't think of a lion in the context of speaking grammatical English. And for a lot of our students, you know, they have never encountered a religious personality. face to face. They've never looked at the world from a religious point of view. They know much more about the modern Orthodox lifestyle and the modern Orthodox life. And we have to not only do the work that we're doing for the couple from the Midwest, we actually have to take the couple from down the block and bring them to. And that makes things harder. And the price is much higher. We're dealing with things that are much more important. With all due respect to a Broadway play, these are more difficult, more important things in life. On the other hand, though, the fact that we know that it's important is a motivating factor. And I hesitate to say it, but it's a time when one has to come out of the closet and say these things. When we're teaching Torah, even when we're studying liberal arts with the right kind of perspective, there's somebody in the room who is not sitting there simply to prepare for the exam and get free credits, who's not in the room to get paid for administering the exam and giving the people free credits. There's somebody there who's giving the exam that really counts to both the Talmidim and to the instructor. We're doing in the presence of God. It may not always be palpable, but he's there with us. And that's a motivating factor. It should be a motivating factor. Cool. About 10 years ago, there was a Purim Suda. The person who said this is present, and there are a couple of other people who were there who were present as well. There's one of the guys, Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin, said, Mrs. Carmi, is there any philosopher that you read? And she was 90 years old, but still, you know, knew what she was, what to say, circumstances. And she said, Camus. Did I like Camus? You know, whether Camus should count as a philosopher's discussion for another time. I mean, I know that Amichai wrote a paper in the Existentialism course last year, and he defended Camus as a serious philosopher. I'm sure my mother would have been happy with that. And let me tell you, my mother's Camus was not the Myth of Sisyphus. I don't know if she finished reading it, but she certainly didn't care for the idea of absurdity the way Camus presented it there. Her Camus was a pest, L'Homme de Voltaire, La Tombe, which she interpreted unironically, so I don't know whether she would have been able to get tenure in most French departments just as well as she never tried. But still, turn back to the Myth of Sisyphus as we think about how impossible our task is educating ourselves and educating other people. Certainly paint a very bleak picture the last couple of minutes. But let me look for an equivalent in Chazal. You know, quote in English, time is short. Yalkut Shimoni, Parshat Ekev and Kriyat Shema, Yalkut Shimoni says, don't say, I can't hear all the Torah to absorb all the commandments written in it, which it is written, Arukami Eretz Midah. Its measure is longer than the entire earth. He says, it's like a king, the Midrash says. He had an endlessly deep pit. He told a member of his family to hire workers to fill the pit. He hired workers. The foolish one went and gazed at the pit and said, when will I fill it? It's impossible. The shrewd worker said, what do I care? I am hired for the day. I rejoice that I found work for myself. So God says to him, what do you care? You're hired for the day. Do your day's work. The obvious message is clear. If I hadn't seen this Midrash, and it's one of the advantages of doing what I do, is that it really is Arukah Mi'eretz Midah, and I'd be happy that at this stage of my life there's so much Torah I don't know yet. People say I've wasted my life doing other things. Or whether to be exhilarated that there's still so much to discover and think about. I don't recall seeing this Midrash until recently. And if I hadn't had that Midrash, I could have quoted the Mishnah in Avot. Yom Katsar, Melacha Merubah, the day is short, there's so much work to do, and the Baal HaBayit is pressing you. It would have suited my purposes almost as well. But now I look at this Midrash, whether for the first time, or maybe I saw it before, I didn't really notice what I needed to notice. And I noticed something about this Midrash I hadn't noticed before. The king, first of all, the king did not hire the workers directly. The person who actually hired the workers was a family member, not the king himself. Again, the foolish worker despairs at the cosmic insignificance of his labors, and the shrewd worker is satisfied to do his work with no illusions about its cosmic importance. But neither worker has encountered the king prior to being hired. The shrewd worker has a sense of simcha that he's doing his job, but he's anonymous. He has no reason to assume that the king knows him or cares about him. Only when the story unfolds, after the Midrash has already delivered judgment of these two workers, at the very end, the king dispenses the foreman, and the king goes over to the shrewd worker, addresses him directly, and he commends him, says, you're right. Now, second thing here, the king does not assure that worker that his assignment has some obscure, hitherto unsuspected, world-changing impact. He doesn't tell him how wonderful he is. He doesn't even tell him that he's doing a great job. I mean, unlike the Mishnah Avot, there's nothing there but reward. All the king does is remind him, says, you're right, you are fortunate to have a day's work. And that day's work awaits him. In a way, this is what it means to go in to do your work in your own self-development, your own Torah study, your own self-examination, and what you're doing for other people. This is, in a certain way, an image of how God is present to us then. We enter into a commitment, and we're committed to God, but we have no sense at all of how God is committed to us and whether he's along with us, when he's present with us in what we're doing. And we sometimes delude ourselves to think that if God were present, it would manifest itself in giving us compliments, in celebrating us, telling us how special we are. And there may be such moments. But the day-by-day work, there comes a time when we're aware that the Bhagavan is with us. And his presence to us is not that of a judge rewarding us or a teacher giving us a gold star. Or doting parents buying a brand new car. It's the presence of a co-worker, solidarity. Somebody saying, I know you're on the job. Go ahead. Keep doing this work. Grateful to many, many hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. Those in this room, you know, many of them are especially important to me, but they're also here as representatives of the ones who are not in this room and some of them will have the opportunity to hear this tape, assuming the tape comes out properly. And there's some people whom I have not yet met, and I look forward to meeting them, and perhaps they'll listen to this tape and they'll be a little bit more prepared for experiencing me, assuming that that's an experience that has any value to them.